long-distant impacts in a chain of events following a tipping point, and then three, the global cascade, a domino effect of tipping points interacting. Does that sound like a reasonable framework for our chat?
Absolutely, yeah.
So, your comment in Nature begins with tipping points, but it doesn't end there. But to be sure we're all on board here, Tim Lenton, how do you describe a tipping point?
Well, I like to use the common example of an ordinary chair to explain to people that the world is full of systems that have different stable states. And in the case of the chair, chair upright is a stable state, but chair lying on its back is also a stable state. And if you're leaning back on the chair, you get to a point where a little bit of a nudge one way or the other is going to determine whether you're back upright or lying flat on your back. And that's the kind of tipping point in the simple case of a chair. There are lots of parts of the Earth's climate system that are a whole lot more complex than chairs, but can also exhibit different stable states and tipping points between them. So an example might be the Greenland ice sheet, where if you were to take it away under today's climate, it wouldn't regrow. And the thing that's allowing it to persist is that it's stuck 3 kilometres up in the air and the temperature's much colder up there, so that keeps the surface cold and enables the ice sheet to persist. But at some point, as you warm the ice sheet up and it starts to melt and the surface drops in altitude and that warms things up further, at some point that process that's self-amplifying becomes self-propelling and you reach a tipping point where you'd lose that ice sheet altogether. So that's one of several examples in the climate.
Yes, has the Amazon rainforest gone past a tipping point?
Let's hope not. I think at some smaller scales, we might say that the Amazon is showing signs of getting tipped, especially in the drier southeast part of the Amazon, where it's not just that people are chopping the forest down, but the recent extreme drought summers that have hit the Amazon have led to a change in fire regimes so that sometimes we're seeing bits of the forest transition away from forest to something more like a savanna. For the bulk of the forest, it's not tipped yet, but we know that the Amazon forest recycles its own rainfall, and that's the way in which it kind of sustains itself. But if you take out too many of the trees, especially in the wrong place, then you would kind of shut off that water recycling system, and that could doom the rest of the forest on a larger scale.
Could whole regions go past a tipping point, but we don't know it yet, even in science, so we only see them in a rear-view mirror?
Well, this is a potential problem with ice sheets and with any system that is naturally sluggish or slow. If you think about ice, it flows very, very slowly, and there's a huge bulk of ice both on Greenland, West Antarctica, and particularly East Antarctica. We think we see evidence in part of West Antarctica and a small part of East Antarctica that the ice sheets there are being destabilized. They're undergoing an accelerating retreat of glaciers. But because that's quite a sluggish system, that at the rate it's going at the moment, it will still take thousands of years, happily, for it to unfold, for the complete loss of something like the West Antarctic ice sheet. But this gets worse as the temperature goes up. So the more we warm the climate, the quicker things can unfold.
Your group, which I note includes my hero, Hans Schellenhuber, then proposes...
Yeah.
It's a great group, a lot from the Potsdam Institute and so on. They propose a long-distance impact in a chain of events following a tipping point. And I think the one that came clearest to me in your article, it would be a change in the North Atlantic Current. Could you talk to us about how something that happens in one part of the Earth could affect the whole globe, possibly?
Absolutely. The crucial thing here is that the Earth and its climate is a complex but interconnected system. So what we begin to see in terms of accelerating change in the world is we see the Arctic warming up far faster than the global average, partly because the sea ice is melting, exposing a darker ocean surface that's absorbing more heat. And that amplified warming in the Arctic is contributing to the melt of the Greenland ice sheet that's also accelerating. That's adding fresh water into the North Atlantic Ocean, either side of Greenland. And those are exactly the regions where deep water forms, water from goes right from the surface of the Atlantic Ocean to the very bottom, and that's a crucial part of propelling what we call the overturning circulation of the Atlantic, that includes massive surface currents of the ocean transporting heat from the southern hemisphere to the northern hemisphere, and then across in the Gulf Stream, across the Atlantic Ocean. And that's weakening that circulation, partly because of extra fresh water coming in to the North Atlantic region. And we know from the Earth's climate past, the record of that, that when you weaken that circulation, it drags the whole band of rainfall around the tropics of the planet a little bit southwards, because there's less of this heat transport by the ocean. And that in turn can disrupt monsoons in West Africa, in South America where the Amazon is, around the planet in India. And when you weaken the heat transport from the south to the north, you also leave more of the heat behind in the Southern Ocean, and that can contribute to the melting of the ice sheets around Antarctica. So it's in that kind of physical way, through the transport of heat, moisture, momentum, that the oceans, the atmosphere, couple the planet together.
Now, is that what you mean by a global cascade? Because that sounds so risky, it's as final almost as a thermonuclear war. If we get one tipping point causing other tipping points and it just goes out of control, is that what you're discussing in the paper?
Well, we're raising the possibility that there can be, that the causal connections and interactions between what I call the tipping elements in the climate can be wired up in a way where one thing increases the likelihood of tipping another. And that does seem to be the kind of causality that I just described in the example I gave. It would require some special conditions for this to become a runaway process, like tipping the proverbial dominoes. It needs the coupling to be quite strong for tipping one thing to force the tipping of the next. But it seems to be, we think, a legitimate concern, and obviously something that we should assess carefully to get a proper handle on the amount of risk we're running with climate change. And we're particularly interested in this because we look in Earth's past and we see times when the planet was much hotter than today, with unusual temperature gradient between the equator and the pole and so on. And models that we have to model today's climate, they really struggle to reproduce these past what we'd call hothouse Earth states. But we know they existed, so we have a suspicion that there are either some of these tipping cascades or some other very strong feedbacks in the climate that can propel the whole Earth to go into a hotter state. And we've got to try and avoid that, if that's possible, to occur.
Definitely. I'd like to go back to your 2018 paper that you co-authored, Trajectories of the Earth System in the Anthropocene. Just a really groundbreaking shake-up paper. In Figure 2 of that paper, it shows two possible futures for us. One is labeled stabilized Earth, and the other is hothouse Earth. It almost sounds in this new paper that we may have to give up on stabilized Earth, and our best hope is just to slow down our fall, drag it out as long as possible, heading towards hothouse Earth. Is that the way people are feeling these days?
Maybe one or two people are feeling it's that bleak. My personal view is we've still got a lot to play for, and there's still a chance we can create a stabilized Earth, but we might, at least in temperature terms, that ought to still be possible and should be something to aim for. What's unclear at the moment is whether we've made a commitment for a wet house Earth, a higher sea level, basically, because we may have already tipped the loss of some big ice sheets, even if it's unfolding slowly over thousands of years. So it might be possible to reverse that, because these are ice sheets that are melting slowly. We'd obviously have to keep things cool if we wanted to try and reverse it. So, yeah, where I'm at with it is we've got a chance to still to create a stabilized Earth, but we've clearly got some work to do to achieve that. We might still be in a situation where some of the sea level rise, albeit coming slowly, has got a certain inevitability about it. I don't think we'd be wise to sort of vote for going through one of those incredible sort of convulsions of the planet. It would be a very, very risky place to be. And that's, I guess, the kind of risks I'm trying to articulate with this latest paper. But I believe that there's still the opportunity to build, create, make a much better, brighter, more sustainable future, which has obviously got to be powered by sustainable energy sources, and it's got to be based on recycling all the materials we need to make new stuff out of the old stuff we have, just as the biosphere does. And I guess that's the kind of stark or interesting choice we've presented ourselves with now. I don't think anyone would want to voluntarily go for the climate apocalypse, but if we don't change the trajectory we're on, I'm afraid that's where we're heading. And yeah, my other work is about saying, okay, we're not going to retreat either, I don't think, in the sense of we're not going to lower global energy consumption. Well, there's no sign of that. So instead, we need a kind of way through this that's towards a sustainable energy, material recycling, flourishing future for people that doesn't wreck the planet.
And then there's a paper published in PNAS in 2008, and it showed systems can appear to reach an equilibrium just before they break into a significant change of state. You and your co-author Chris Bolton wrote about that in 2015. I interviewed Chris on Radio EcoShock. So that's really another trap. Things can look very stable, just nice and calm, and then they shift radically and they never go back. That makes it hard to communicate the risks. I mean, it seems like everything's going okay right now, but it could turn bad quickly.
I know there's a certain irony in the fact that a complex system can actually become more sluggish in response to all the nudges it's getting from the world before it undergoes a really dramatic tipping point kind of change. It can be made to seem intuitive if it's possible to understand that any system with these different stable states has these mechanisms that we call feedbacks that, by definition, if it has a stable state, try to drag it back to whatever that preferred state is. But when we're seeing a system heading towards a tipping point, we're essentially seeing those stabilizing mechanisms starting to break down and get weaker. And that's why, as you're heading towards a tipping point, when you nudge a system, it actually recovers more slowly from the nudges you're giving it. And that's a signal we've successfully looked for in some past cases of approaches to abrupt climate change, for example. But it is, like all of this science of complex systems and ones involving the biosphere as well, it is inherently sometimes a little counterintuitive and interesting how these things behave. And that's, I guess, how people like me can make their living, spending 25 years of their life trying to grapple with this sometimes unintuitive complexity and then try and explain it to everybody else.
Well, it's amazing that apes can get into their brains how the whole universe works and or even try to do something like that, but we do.
We do, yeah.
Yeah. How big, Tim, do you think our remaining carbon budget is before we cross tipping points?
Well, I fear that we might have crossed one or two in the ice sheets, and we're just not absolutely sure about that because it's not super easy to observe the slow dynamics unfolding in inhospitable places of the world, like around the edges of Antarctica. So we might be at a tipping point for some triggering some slow ice sheet losses. I hope we're not. But if that's not the case, I think we're really running into dangerous territory if we're going towards 1.5 degrees of global warming from the current 1 degree and a bit in centigrade, that is. And the remaining budget to stay within, to try and limit the warming to 1.5 degrees, it's maybe around 400, possibly 500 billion tons of CO2. But that budget's probably being eaten away at by the fact that we're triggering some tipping point loss of carbon.
Well, like you, I think the rate of change may be the key. It may be the thing that we can control and our best hope. It would be great if we could slow this shift down enough to allow natural selection and evolution to help transition the species. But at our current rate, that doesn't seem like that time will be there. What do you think?
Well, certainly not for natural selection in the sense of based on genetics and population genetics. That's generally pretty slow. In the human realm, of course, we have something else which we loosely call cultural evolution. It's clear that humans are evolving far faster than evolution purely based on genetics. And instead, cultural evolution probably took hold thousands of years ago and is absolutely dominating now. And that, what I mean by that is we have these different symbolic forms and language forms in which we communicate information, and we sometimes imitate each other's behaviours, and so on and so forth. So we'd like to comfort ourselves, I think, that we're a pretty adaptable species, partly because we have this cultural evolution. But of course, it's the same cultural evolution in the form of the Industrial Revolution and everything else that's been driving the problem. And we can't deny at the same time that we're biological beings, and we've got some physiological limits to what we can tolerate. So simple things like our temperature tolerance is not going to magically evolve. And we see a real risk in these climate change model scenarios that large parts of the planet start to get to temperatures that become pretty physiologically intolerable in parts of the years in heat waves for all mammals, including humans. So, yeah, there's some basic biological constraints we're not going to evolve our way out of. But maybe there's some hope if we can perhaps change the way we're culturally evolving.
And where does your work go from here, Tim?
Well, I would really like to focus a bit more of my energy on how can we tip positive change to avoid the really bad climate tipping points. I think the problem for someone like me, I trained as a scientist, as an environmental scientist, is we're so used to diagnosing the problem, and we're getting spectacularly good at diagnosing the problem and telling everybody else about it. But what the world's crying out for now, I think, is probably a roadmap of the solutions. And how are we going to transform ourselves into a flourishing, sustainable future? So I'm trying to spend some energy now identifying where are the possible positive tipping points to tip that transformation that we know we need to a sustainable future. Where can we find those, and how might we activate them? I have to say I'm having to learn a lot along the way, but that's the joy of being an academic, is you get a kick out of learning new things and thinking about new problems.
We have been speaking with UK professor and director of Global Systems Institute at Exeter, Dr. Tim Lenton. The paper, Climate Tipping Points, Too Risky to Bet Against, is available free. You could just Google that, or you can look in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Tim, thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
Well, thanks for the insightful questions and getting me onto all the interesting territory. That was great.
That was a refresher interview from Radio Ecoshock, broadcast January 8th, 2020. It may have been edited for length. 4 years on, a new report on global tipping points is out, and we will go there soon. Maybe you will need this. Are you afraid? Lots of people are trying to evaluate the appropriate level of panic, whether to check supplies in the bunker, run away, or just pull up the covers and hide. I have thoughts. Starting with a story, I did not know there was a revolution on both land and sea around 100 million years ago. The marine revolution reminds me of medieval castle building. The stone defenses became thicker and more intricate in castles until more powerful cannon arrived. Then castles became expensive holdovers, no match for new war methods. For hundreds of millions of years, many ocean creatures built protective calcium shells, like castle walls. Then, in a period when continents were moving and climate changed the sea levels, two new types of species appeared. One had jaws that could crunch shells. The others were worm-like creatures which could eat or dissolve small holes in the shells, and then enter through those breaches to devour the interior. Whole orders of creatures, including the brachiopods I collected as fossils as a kid, were wiped out. On land, between 150 million years ago, again believed to be due to climate change, flowering plants appeared in a terrestrial revolution. It was a wild time of creation, of new shapes and colors. Flowering plants decorated this planet. Their arrival also drove development of new predators, and it prodded evolution of coexisting creatures like ants. A crazy number of ant species comes from that same time. I'm sure there is something deep in all that. My whole life, and all human life, have been living on the edge of utter disaster since the development of nuclear weapons deliverable by missiles or bombers. One big flash, everything goes quiet, and dark nuclear winter sets in for 8 to 10 years. Whatever survives begins again. Humanity suffered mass fears, real and imagined, as long as we have written records. One foundational source of multiple threats is the Hebrew Bible and the three religions believing in it, the people of the book. God sends floods, fires, pestilence, plagues. God approves his people committing genocide on others in the land of Canaan. Through thousands of years, the most settled people and seemingly powerful empires experienced a sudden arrival of hostile armies bent on looting and killing. Some attackers destroyed the cities of their victims and burned whatever could burn. The Mongols come to mind. During the late 1100s and 1200 CE, a relative warming developed in Europe, part of long-term natural cycles. With better weather and thus improved crop yields, population increased. Then, in the middle of the 1300s, the Black Plague arrived. Conservative estimates find over half the population of Europe died. COVID, deadly and crippling as it is not as bad as the plague, which struck before any conceptions of science and modern medicine. Therefore, it is realistic and well-founded to sense the fragility of life. But that helpful evolutionary trait can attack societies and the mind like an autoimmune disease. History is filled with episodes of mass fear based on rational fears that did not happen. Some fast-spreading panics were based on mass delusion, difficult for the modern mind to comprehend. European Christians were instructed to prepare for the end times any day when Jesus returns to fight epic battles with the devil. They promised most of humanity will be wiped out. These teachings were deeply embedded since earliest childhood and reinforced weekly, if not daily. Periodically, masses of poor people walked away from their homes in search of a miracle or a crusade or just to wait for the Messiah. They died or were enslaved. Call it superstition, but it survives well in modern minds and societies. This long-standing, culturally inbred mass fear is used daily by Western news media, movies, and more. All that big fear goes on high-speed overdrive through telephones and social media. We've never seen anything like it for the fast communication of fear. The most frightening videos, blogs, and podcasts are rewarded by actual views and by advertising-driven algorithms. Be aware, built-in mass fear is being stimulated and used against you. Be suspicious of the next rumor that collapse is coming tomorrow. Whether you choose to let that panic survival network that's developed in your brain kick in, when and how much, it is still a choice for most people. A few people may not be able to control the fear. Complicating the great fear, there is a tendency to confuse our own sense of unavoidable death and widespread death for others. We think the world ends when we do. We find this especially in older men and less in women. Some older men specialize in preaching doom, the kind of hell that will appear either soon or on a predicted date. They may claim a vision or signs, whether religious or not. The end times they preach is more likely their own end, their own under-acknowledged sense of mortality. While mass mortality events are possible, maybe even getting more probable, no one knows the future for sure, or at least in detail. This universe and life in it takes surprising twists. You've seen it. Anyone with a true vision of the future is deluded and may want you to share that delusion. Be open to the idea that the future is an open system. That may not save you or people around you. the open future may be another terrestrial revolution where long-known species disappear and unsuspected life forms triumph. Perhaps comforting and helpful for orientation, time is relative for each of us. For seniors, the wrenching collapse and new world order is unlikely to come in their few remaining years. And if it does come, and I must starve, I will, without great regrets. My life has been rich, more than all humans before me could have expected. The sadness and fear I feel for my kids and grandchildren needs to be limited, and when I can, I redirect it into action, however useless or small it may seem. Why waste time and mental energy on despair? Why run away from remaining life? We can keep growing in understanding, in gifting, in art. New secrets of deep time and space are offered to us daily. Learn anything, learn everything. As you explore the birth of flowering plants 100 million years ago, or the birth in all living things now, something in your core feels joy. It is permissible to feel joy, even in the darkest days. As Holocaust survivor Viktor Frankl explained in his book, Man's Search for Meaning, there were marriages celebrated in the death camps. Personal growth and happiness can repel mass fear and despair if you let it. Enjoy yourself, even if it is later than you think. That is how I try to survive, despite knowing what I know. Let happiness, or at least contentment, bloom in your heart and mind for part of every day. Celebrate small things and occasions. Pass on a little love, or at least understanding and empathy. Help someone or something. Find living nature daily if possible. Look at the sky, spend time under it. Notice and nurture pleasure and good moments. If you are lost in memories, choose good destinations for your mind travel, not trauma and mistakes. Life is ludicrous and wild. Laugh. Next week, I will bring you more expert voices explaining humanity and life as we know it are in deeper trouble. Efforts and chances to save ourselves are tiny, but not non-existent. If you cannot handle it, maybe tune out for a while, disconnect and go outside, breathe deep, and then try again. Along the way in this radio journey, we also recover millions of years of lost memory of this planet. We acquire new amazement at the working of this planetary home, and yes, we talk with the continuing genius of humans. Amid warnings of dark death technologies, new ways of life and life-saving methods are also flocking into time. These are exciting times to be alive. Cherish them. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
Dr. Tim Lenton, Radio EcoShock 2023.
There are probably other Earths that we weren't drawing on the diagram as well that are possible. I would call one of them the wet house Earth, where we've lost major ice sheets, the sea levels are much higher, and the continental coastlines are redrawn. But yeah, it's luckily, we're still in a situation where there is overall quite a lot of amplifying feedback in the system, but not enough to send us over the metaphorical cliff edge into hothouse Earth. Basically, we're in a situation where, with no feedbacks at all, except for the sort of fundamental laws of physics, if we doubled the carbon dioxide level in the atmosphere, we would have expected about 1.2 degrees centigrade of warming, whereas including the feedbacks we know about, we expect that number to be more like 3 degrees centigrade on the century timescale and could be as much as 6 degrees centigrade on the long millennial timescale. So that's saying that there is a lot of overall amplification in the climate system, but crucially it's not at the point where it will go into runaway and just be self-propelling warming, which is the hothouse Earth scenario. We still need to really work out how plausible and how much extra push it needs to get to hothouse Earth. But the crucial thing is, if you have a system that's already quite a strong amplifier, and there's some feedback you miss that is just a little bit of extra amplification where it adds disproportionately onto what you already have. And people who do electrical engineering and make circuits and actual real amplifiers know this quite well. So that's the crucial stuff we're trying to get to the bottom of, and hopefully this paper helps a little bit.